Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. The U.S. Secretary of State says the Iran nuclear deal has made the world a safer place. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the multinational deal designed to end Iran's quest for nuclear weapons has made the world a safer place. In a wide-ranging speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos on Friday, Kerry said because of the Iran nuclear deal, an additional source of danger in the Middle East has been removed.
We are on the cusp of confrontation, believe me. I can't tell you how many leaders, when I traveled through certain areas, said, you have to bomb it. That's the way you will solve this problem. Now, because of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, whose implementation we formally certified this past weekend, Iran's path to building a bomb has been closed off.
Kerry touted the work of the International Coalition battling Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria, pledging to defeat them. He also said the best way to ensure peace in the region is to work toward a negotiated political settlement in Syria, something he has pledged to continue pursuing this week. The stop in Davos is taking place ahead of Kerry's February 2nd meeting in Rome with about two dozen foreign ministers from countries that are part of the anti-Islamic State coalition in Iraq and Syria. He's scheduled to travel to Saudi Arabia, the next leg of a five-nation tour that includes stops in Asia. Greek maritime officials say at least 15 bodies have been recovered in two separate sinkings of boats off Greek islands Friday as a seemingly unending wave of migrants continues to travel over treacherous winter waters to seek refuge in Europe. A search is underway for other migrants still missing. This is VOA News. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden said during a trip to Turkey Friday that intimidating the media, curtailing internet freedom, and accusing academics of treason was not setting a good example in the Middle East. Speaking on a two-day visit to the NATO ally and key member of the U.S.-led alliance against Islamic State in neighboring Syria and Iraq, Biden said the strength of Turkish democracy had a direct impact on the strength of ties with the United States. The president of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta, visited Nairobi's Armed Forces Memorial Hospital Friday and expressed condolences and gratitude to the soldiers who were killed, injured, or missing as a result of the recent al-Shabaab attack on Kenya's base in El Ade, Somalia. Many of the families are still awaiting word about their loved ones as the government has not released casualty totals and many of the troops' whereabouts continue to remain unknown. Al-Shabaab said it killed up to 100 Kenyan soldiers in the attack, a figure that has not been independently confirmed. During Friday's ceremony, President Kenyatta said Kenya's defense forces will remain in Somalia. Kenyan forces working with the African Union have been battling al-Shabaab militants inside Somalia since October of 2011. News from North Korea. It says it has detained a U.S. student on suspicion of carrying out an unspecified hostile act against the state. The Korean Central News Agency reports the student, identified as Otto Frederick Warmbier from the University of Virginia, entered North Korea as a tourist intending to destroy the country's unity. KCNA did not lay out the student's alleged crimes, but did say his acts were tolerated and manipulated by the U.S. government. It did not elaborate, but said an investigation was underway. According to his LinkedIn page, Warmbier is an undergraduate student of economics and global sustainability. He was arrested January 2nd while on a tour of North Korea arranged by Young Pioneer Tours, according to the Reuters news agency. The tour company said it was doing all it could to secure Warmbier's release. State Department spokesman John Kirby said it was aware of the media reports and that the welfare of U.S. citizens is one of the department's highest priorities. North Korea detained several Americans in recent years, most of them journalists, students, or Christians accused of proselytizing. Most of the time, the detainees are released, sometimes after visits to the country by current or former U.S. officials. Last month, North Korea sentenced a 60-year-old Canadian pastor to life in prison with hard labor for subversion. CNN reported earlier this month that Pyongyang also detained a Korean-American man on suspicion of spying. I'm Ira Melman reporting from Washington.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
we owe our young soldiers a debt of gratitude, one we can scarcely begin to repay, but we shall honor them, and honor them we will.
That's Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta expressing condolences to victims of the recent attack by Al-Shabaab militants on a Kenyan military installation in Somalia. Also, police in Somalia's capital say at least 20 people have been killed by gunmen who stormed into a popular seaside restaurant and took siege of the eatery. Tunisia's government imposes a nationwide overnight curfew as violent protests over high unemployment continue. And a new survey shows that poverty levels have dropped in 22 of 33 countries surveyed. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from South Africa, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, police in Somalia's capital say at least 20 people have been killed by gunmen who stormed into a popular seaside restaurant and took siege of the eatery. The militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the attack at the Lido Beach View Hotel in Mogadishu. Somali police officer Mohamed Abdurrahman said today the assault was a barbaric and brutal attack against innocent civilians. The assailants attacked the restaurant yesterday, setting off explosions and firing on guests. A top Somali intelligence official told VOA Somali Service that security forces flushed out the militants from the building and captured the leader of the gunmen. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has expressed condolences to victims of the recent attack by Al-Shabaab militants on a Kenyan military installation in Somalia. A number of soldiers remain unaccounted for. VOA's Jill Craig speaks to families of some of the missing soldiers.
During a ceremony at Nairobi's Armed Forces Memorial Hospital Friday, President Uhuru Kenyatta expressed condolences and gratitude to the soldiers and families of soldiers who were killed, injured, and missing as a result of the recent Al-Shabaab attack on Kenya's base in El Ade, Somalia.
We owe our young soldiers a debt of gratitude, one we can scarcely begin to repay, but we shall honor them, and honor them we will.
Many of the families are still awaiting word about their loved ones, since the government has not released official numbers and many of the troops' whereabouts continue to remain unknown. Kosge Lamokwo is among those waiting to find out what happened to his brother Abraham, who he says has been in the army for 25 years, but Lamokwo is urging patience for others in his situation. He says the families who are affected by this crisis just have to wait and be patient for the government to finish its verification process. He says the government hasn't yet released the final list of the dead, missing, and those who were rescued. Ephraim Madula Anjeri's son, Stephen, joined the Kenyan Defense Forces in 2010. After previous deployments to Somalia and northeastern Kenya, he was sent to El Ade just 2 weeks ago. Anjeri disagrees with Lamokwo, saying the government needs to provide the families with timely information.
At least what the government should tell us, first, they could visit the affected families, talk to the affected families, do counseling and guiding, and then tell us to be patient as they do the search, instead of leaving us in darkness, because this is a thing that has traumatized many families. They need guiding and counseling.
During Friday's ceremony, President Kenyatta said Kenya's defense forces will remain in Somalia.
We are at war with extremists. We are at war with terrorists. We are at war with fanatics. And this has to be a war that we must win. Despite the adversity, we remain unbowed and resolved to build a strong, prosperous, and secure nation.
Kenyan troops working with the African Union have battled Al-Shabaab militants inside Somalia since October 2011. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
15 UN Security Council diplomats met early today in Burundi's capital with First Vice President Gaston Sindimwo to seek resolution to the country's months-long security and human rights dilemma. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports that U.S. Ambassador to the UN and other delegates later met with civil society leaders whose views support political opposition to the government. That meeting was held outside Karuzi, a three-hour drive from Bujumbura. The delegates are scheduled to meet President Pierre Nkurunziza later today. Mr. Nkurunziza had denied any domestic instability and said he would treat an African Union peacekeeping force as invaders. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power tweets that the climate for fear in Bujumbura is sobering. She says the U.N. delegates met with civil society leaders who shaped the Arusha Accords, which set Burundi on path to peace more than a year ago. Yesterday, the opposition forces of the Republican Forces of Burundi named a former intelligence chief, General Godfried Niyombare, as their commander. Niyombare is now in exile. The rebel group was formed in December 2015 to oust President Pierre Nkurunziza from power. That coup attempt failed. The president's three-year term in office set off the conflict last year. UN estimates put the death toll at 439 people, but it says it could be higher. More than 240,000 people have fled abroad. In Tunisia, the government has imposed a nationwide overnight curfew as violent protests over high unemployment continue. The Associated Press says the curfew was in effect from 8 p.m. until 5 a.m. following attacks and vandalism on private and public property. Police stations came under attack. Police used tear gas to disperse protesters who the stones and Molotov cocktails. Tunisia is already under a state of emergency that was imposed in November after a suicide bombing killed 12 members of the Presidential Guard in Tunis. It's the deadliest January on record for migrants and refugees trying to reach Europe. The International Organization for Migration says well over 100 people have died so far this month. That's more than the past two Januaries combined. The AP reports 42 people drowned, including 17 children, in two separate smuggling boat accidents overnight off the Greek islands. The IOM says while deaths on the waters between Turkey and Greece is almost a daily occurrence, there have been just two known shipwrecks between Libya and Italy so far this year. More than 3,000 migrants and refugees died last year trying to reach Europe. So far this year, nearly 37,000 migrants and refugees have arrived by sea in Greece and Italy. That's about 10 times higher than the same period last year. In related news, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is calling on nations to redouble their efforts to solve the refugee crisis and combat the rising threat of terrorism. Addressing the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Kerry announced President Obama will host a summit at the UN later this year on the refugee crisis. Well, France's prime minister has joined growing voices in warning that Europe's ongoing migrant crisis threatens the very foundations of the 28-member EU. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
French Prime Minister Manuel Valls says the tens of thousands of migrants who continue pouring into Europe threaten the very idea of a unified region, especially when it comes to the passport-free Schengen zone.
Oui, elle peut disparaître, bien sûr, le projet européen, pas l'Europe en tant que telle.
Speaking to the BBC at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Valls said if Europe is not capable of protecting its borders, the so-called European Project or European Union is in danger of disappearing. Roughly 1 million migrants arrived in Europe last year, many of them fleeing conflict in the Middle East, Asia, and Africa, but tens of thousands of others arrived hoping for better economic opportunities. Today, a growing number of European countries are introducing border controls to curb the influx, and Hungary has built a fence on its border with Croatia. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is facing growing pressure after welcoming in hundreds of thousands of migrants last year.
Faut aller vite, faut beaucoup de moyens mis pour protéger nos frontières.
Vance said external border controls are essential. EU members also need to be more active, he said, in weeding out economic migrants who should be sent home. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has also warned this week that Europe was close to the breaking point. The chief of Eurogroup finance ministers, Jeroen Dijsselbloem, said in Davos that Europe needs to spend much more to deal with the crisis where refugees are located in the Middle East. Separately, Valls said France's state of emergency, announced after November's terrorist attacks in Paris, would remain in place until the so-called total battle against the Islamic State group is over. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 16 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Police in Somalia's capital say at least 20 people have been killed by gunmen who stormed into a popular seaside restaurant and took siege of the eatery. Kenya's president expresses condolences to victims of the recent attack by Al-Shabaab militants on a Kenyan military installation in Somalia. And Tunisia's government imposes a nationwide overnight curfew as violent protests over high unemployment continue. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. A new survey by the South Africa-based Afrobarometer shows that poverty levels have dropped in 22 of 33 countries surveyed. Afrobarometer is a nonpartisan research network that conducts public attitude surveys on democracy, governance, economic conditions, and related issues. Robert Mathis is a professor of political science at the University of Cape Town and senior advisor for Afrobarometer. He told reporter William Eagle that several factors influence poverty, including the amount of support given education, health, and development infrastructure.
But we also find that where states build development infrastructure, people do much better. What we've done is in each community, when we do the interviews, so our interviewers will do eight interviews with our field workers do eight interviews with randomly chosen respondents in a census enumerated area that's been randomly chosen. And while that's going on, the field supervisor will go around the area and visually observe or ask about the presence of certain services. So do they see a paved road? Is there a sewage network? Is there an electricity grid that most people can access? Is there piped water, et cetera? And we're in those sampling areas that have things, that have a paved road, have sewage, have an electric grid, have piped water system. They have a health clinic within walking distance. Those people who live in those areas experience these shortages, experience the poverty far less frequently than the people who live in areas that have not been have these services built.
You found that in North Africa, many governments that are authoritarian spent more on education and infrastructure, social services, compared to sub-Saharan Africa. But you also cite some impressive strides in Africa among democracies like South Africa, Zambia, Cape Verde, and Ghana.
You know, you correctly mentioned that Zambia, Ghana, and Cape Verde are the three places. I mean, Cabo Verde also has received a lot of credit from the Millennium Challenge account and from other international sources in terms of its ability to, through good governance, to wisely put into effect the kind of funds it's received from various donors. And those are the only three countries we have that our data going back to 2002 show a long-time consistent trend in falling poverty. There are Senegal, Namibia, and South Africa that we see more recent decreases going back to about 2008. But in all those countries, poverty had actually increased in the previous about 6 years, and then they have fallen since then. South Africa is one of those countries where poverty has fallen more recently. I mean, I think still South Africa has had to deal with a long-term employment crisis, which, is, I think, is especially acute for an industrialized society. But it all had the very severe HIV/AIDS epidemic. But I think, you know, now we see the cumulative effect of a very expansive social welfare network, which has been put in place by the government. We are not clear how long it's going to be sustained. That it's really pushing the edges of the envelope in terms of budgetary stability. But South Africa now has one of the largest numbers of people in the world, not just in the developing world, but who are receive some form of social welfare grants from government, and that seems to be now one of the factors, along with just the ability that the government keeps every year building more houses, building more clinics, electrifying more townships. And doing those kind of basic things that we find that seem to be the chief drivers of poverty alleviation.
Your study also finds improvements in Zimbabwe. What can you tell us about that?
Zimbabwe, somewhat simply because of the crisis that it went through, leading up to the government of national unity. In many respects, there was a bit of a peace dividend. And some wise decisions, ironically, taken by the MDC partners of the government of national unity, who controlled the finance ministry, who made some wise decisions about the economy, and that helped to stabilize things in Zimbabwe. I think the irony is they didn't receive credit for it. That they weren't very good at telling the voters it was them who was responsible for stabilizing the country and improving things, or they weren't able to claim the credit very well. Largely because of the ZANU-PF government's control of the state news media. The progress, you know, was simply because things had gotten so bad. So poverty had sharply increased in our 2005 survey in Zimbabwe and very much so in the 2008 survey. And then we saw a sharp decrease in the survey that we did there in 2012. So it was simply because things had come back from the abyss in Zimbabwe.
That was Professor Robert Mathis of the University of Cape Town. He spoke with VOA reporter William Eagle. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says it is concerned by developments in Malawi that could stoke anti-gay sentiment, including incitement to murder. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office says it fears the decision by Malawi's chief prosecutor to drop charges against an individual accused of inflammatory statements against gays and lesbians could have serious consequences. Earlier this month, the spokesman of one of the country's main political parties publicly and on several occasions described gay and lesbian people as worse than dogs and called for them to be killed. A criminal case was subsequently lodged against People Party spokesman Kenneth Imsonda by two civil society organizations, charging him with inciting others to break the law. But UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville says the director of public prosecutions decided to discontinue the case on Thursday, one day before Imsonda was due to appear before the Blantyre Magistrate Court.
We're concerned that the failure to prosecute this case sends a dangerous message that inciting others to kill gay people is legitimate and will be tolerated by the authorities, in effect encouraging violent threats and attacks on the gay and lesbian community in Malawi.
Malawi has laws criminalizing consensual same-sex activity by adults. But Colville tells VOA the government has been effectively observing a moratorium on the arrest and prosecution of individuals on charges related to homosexuality since 2012.
It's still on the books, but they haven't been practicing it. But in a sense, this case is completely different. This is incitement to kill. And irrespective of for what reason, that's against the law in Malawi. Killing is against the law.
Human rights organizations report 79 countries criminalize homosexual activities. 34 are in Africa. They say 10 nations with large Muslim populations, among them four in Africa, have laws providing for the death penalty for same-sex intimacy. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An attack on a gas pipeline in Nigeria's oil-rich Niger Delta region has raised fears that a dormant insurgency could be coming back. Chris Stein reports with Hillary Uguru in Ugele, Nigeria.
The attacks last weekend came shortly after a judge in the commercial capital Lagos issued a warrant for the arrest of former Niger Delta militant, Government Ekpemu Polo, better known by his moniker Tom Polo, who is wanted on charges that include money laundering and conspiracy. A gas pipeline that connected to the major Escravos-Lagos pipeline system was attacked. A pipeline that carried crude oil was also damaged, forcing the Nigeria National Petroleum Corporation, or NNPC, to shut down two refineries. Nigeria imports most of its refined products, like gasoline and diesel. President Muhammadu Buhari has made weaning Nigeria off the imports a priority. Dolapo Oni, head of energy research at Ecobank, says this attack is a setback to that effort.
It brings to the fore the fact that we haven't resolved a major issue with the refinery segment in Nigeria, which is protecting the network of pipelines that supply them crude oil.
Nigeria is Africa's largest producer of oil, but much of the income from that industry is lost to corruption. About two-thirds of Nigerians live in poverty, and the communities in the oil-producing Niger Delta are no different. An insurgency by militants fighting for more development rocked the region until the government started paying them off in exchange for peace in 2009. Tom Polo was a major player in that insurgency. The accusations against him come amid a new push against corruption by Buhari's administration. But some in the Niger Delta worry the pipeline attacks are a warning to the government. Come after Tom Polo and you'll pay. Atuyebi Oyebi is a journalist in the town of Ugeli.
If the government does not tame Tom Polo in time, Tom Polo will become a law. And when a man is a law, the state is in trouble.
Nigeria is already struggling with the global drop in oil prices. The pipeline shutdown is yet another blow to the economy. The NNPC says it is losing over $2.3 million from the shutdown daily. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara met opposition leader Pascal Affi N'Guessan yesterday in Abidjan. N'Guessan is the president of the Ivorian Popular Front, the party of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo. The two men were expected to discuss various sensitive subjects, including national reconciliation and the release of political prisoners. Emily Yob reports from Abidjan.
It was only meant to be an hour-long meeting, but Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara and the delegation of the Ivorian Popular Front, the FPI, ended up talking for more than 3 hours. Speaking to the press just after the meeting, Pascal Affi N'Guessan said he was satisfied with his first meeting.
We have seen real progress, he said,
and the political will to settle all problems related to the post-electoral crisis, N'Guessan said. In 2010 and 2011, the results of the presidential elections were disputed and supporters of Ouattara clashed with those of the FPI, then led by incumbent president Laurent Gbagbo. At least 3,000 people died in 5 months of violence, which ended when Gbagbo was arrested and put in jail. He is currently awaiting trial at the International Criminal Court. Thursday's meeting was requested by the FBI mainly to discuss the release of the remaining political prisoners of that post-electoral crisis. On that too, Affi N'Guessan said progress was made. Regarding the political prisoners, he said, the principle of the release was agreed on. FBI spokesperson Agnès Monet said these issues are key for sustainable peace in Ivory Coast. When it comes to national reconciliation, it has always been linked to the problems of the post-electoral crisis, she said. Other subjects discussed included the return of the remaining refugees and the unfreezing of the assets of some of FPI's executives. But not all of the FPI was at this meeting. Since last year, the party has been experiencing a deep internal crisis, which led a section of Gbagbo's supporters to break away from the party and boycott the elections. To them, no talk is possible prior to the release of Laurent Gbagbo, whereas the section of the FPI, led by Affi N'Guessan, has been willing to come back into the political game. Monet says a new meeting with the government may happen in the next few weeks to continue the talks. Emily Yop for VOA News in Abidjan.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 29 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to African News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up right here on the VOA. For the full hour of African News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Police in Somalia's capital say at least 20 people have been killed by gunmen who stormed into a popular seaside restaurant and took siege of the eatery. Kenya's president expresses condolences to victims of the recent attack by Al-Shabaab militants on a Kenyan military installation in Somalia. Tunisia's government imposes a nationwide overnight curfew as violent protests over high unemployment continue. Coming up, we'll have music from South Africa and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand Rwanda's capital was the venue Friday for some exciting football action.
Kim, Nigeria and Tunisia battled to a one-all draw Friday at the African Nations Championship football tournament in Rwanda. After a scoreless first half in the capital, Kigali, Chisom Chikatara put the Super Eagles of Nigeria in front in the 51st minute. It was Chikatara's fourth goal at Rwanda 2016. He had a hat trick in Nigeria's opening match, a 4-1 victory over Niger in Kigali. The Carthage Eagles of Tunisia rallied, though, and the equalizing goal came from a player who, like Chikatara, has been a hungry goal poacher in Rwanda. Ahmed Akachi headed in the equalizer in the 69th minute. It was his third goal of the tournament. Akachi scored both of Tunisia's goals in a two-all draw with Guinea in his team's opening match. Final score from Kigali, Nigeria 1 and Tunisia 1. The result puts Nigeria at the top of Group C with 4 points. Tunisia has 2 points. Remember, VOA football fans, this tournament in Rwanda, also called CHAN, is for locally based players in Africa. In CHAN action Thursday, Group B was in the spotlight with 2 matches in Butare, Rwanda. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma recaps the action for us.
Ethiopia and Cameroon played to a scoreless draw at the Huye Stadium in Butare, some 140 kilometers south of the capital, Kigali, on Thursday. This contrasts with the earlier match at the same venue where fans witnessed 6 goals as the Democratic Republic of Congo dismissed Angola 4-2 in the other Group B tie. Nelson Muganga, Elia Meshak, Jonathan Bolingi, Merville Bope Bokadi each found the back of the net for the Congolese, while Nelson Sumba replied for Angola before the Congolese captain and defender Joel Kimwa converted the tournament's first own goal. Consequently, the Democratic Republic of Congo have 6 points and have qualified for the quarterfinals. Cameroon has 4 points. Ethiopia 1, while Angola has yet to earn a point. Tomorrow, Saturday, Zimbabwe play Mali before Uganda engage Zambia in Group D action at the Umganda Stadium in Gishenyi, some 160 kilometers northwest of the capital, Kigali. On Sunday, Rwanda engage Morocco in Kigali as Ivory Coast play Gabon in Butare in the final round of the Group A preliminaries. I'm Mark Olma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
Because this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Nichabulile.
Hola. Because this is Africa. Tamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Tamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
Voice of America.
Come back, baby, come back. Come back, baby, come back.
Hearty greetings.
If you would like to leave a voicemail for possible use on a future Sunny Side of Sports broadcast, please call 1-202-205-9942. Once again, that number, 1-202-205-9942. When you hear the VOA identification, press 60. And please include your name and where you are calling from.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
More African football news now on the Sunny Side of Sports. Uganda's teenage captain, Farouk Mia, looks like he's going to Belgium after the African Nations Championship in Rwanda. Reports say the 19-year-old Mia is ready to sign with Belgian club Standard Liège. Mia has played the past two seasons with Vipers Sports Club in Uganda. Vipers and Standard Liège have agreed to a transfer fee of about $400,000. Mia scored on a penalty kick in Uganda's opening Chan match and set up his team's other goal in a 2-2 draw with Mali on Tuesday in Gisenyi, Rwanda. Uganda will play Zambia in its next Chan match Saturday in Gisenyi. However, there are question marks about Mia's health for the match. He reportedly has a shoulder injury that could keep him out of the game. Our African football guru, David Legg, says Farouk Mia is one of the bright young stars on the continent, and he's definitely a player to watch in the future. Meanwhile, David says top African football clubs in Tunisia and the Democratic Republic of Congo recently made coaching changes.
Yes, we have reported, Sonny, that Patrice Carteron, the Frenchman, was leaving the African champions TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And another Frenchman, Hubert Velloud, is going to take his place. Interestingly, on just a one-year contract, that's a very short contract. Normally, these contracts are a minimum of 2 years. But Velloud is happy enough to get the chance. He says he's going to work with incredible professionals. The only problem in this job, as I see it, Sonny, is he has to really achieve a lot just to be successful. Mazembe make a habit of winning the African Champions League twice in a row. They did it in 67 and 68. They did it in 2009 and 2010. And now, having won it in 2015, no doubt the owner of the club, Moise Katumbi, he will expect them to retain that title in 2016. So it's a tough task for Velloud in the sense that he basically has to retain that Champions League title to be seen as successful. And then I think Katumbi would also say to him, we had a disastrous time at the FIFA Club World Cup in Japan in 2015. We must do better this time. Mazembe, for the record, finished 6th out of 7. And this is a club who also did poorly in 2009, but in 2010 became the first African team to reach the final of the World Club Championship, unfortunately going down 3-0 to Inter Milan. In another coaching change, Club Africain, the Tunisian champions, they've signed up Ruud Krol, the widely traveled Dutchman. He was a World Cup runner-up in 1974 and 78, Holland losing to Germany and Argentina in consecutive finals. Krol was a no-nonsense centre-back in those days. And since then, he's coached in South Africa. He led Orlando Pirates to 3 trophies in his final year of a 3-year contract. But most of his time has been spent in North Africa, and he's certainly no stranger to Tunisia. He has coached CS Sfaxien and Esperance, and he has also coached briefly the national team. So he has now coached 3 of the top 4 clubs in Tunisia. The only one he's missed out on are Etoile Sahel.
David, I know African club football's top competition is the subject of your latest quiz. Can you give us the question one more time?
Which club has qualified the most times to compete in the CAF Champions League? And that includes the former name of the competition. It was then known as the African Cup of Champions Clubs. So what we're talking about, Sonny, is way back to 1964 when this competition started. So it's between 1964 and 2015. Which club has qualified the most times to compete in the CAF Champions League.
2016 is a leap year, David, so we're going to set a deadline of Monday, February 29th, to get your entries in. David and I will now tell you where you can send your entries.
VOA!
It's david.legg, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France-Presse.com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.legg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. In National Basketball Association news, Kobe Bryant of the Los Angeles Lakers is the leading vote getter for his final NBA All-Star game next month. The NBA All-Star game will be played February 14th in Toronto, Canada. Kobe led all players in the fan balloting with 1.9 million votes, and he was selected an All-Star for the 18th time. Kobe says he's retiring after this season. He'll finish one behind Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the NBA's all-time leading scorer for most All-Star selections. Joining Kobe in the Western Conference starting lineup will be Stephen Curry, the league's reigning most valuable player from the Golden State Warriors, Kevin Durant of the Oklahoma City Thunder, Durant's Thunder teammate Russell Westbrook, and Kawhi Leonard of the San Antonio Spurs. The Eastern Conference All-Stars are led by LeBron James in their starting lineup. Kyle Lowry of the Toronto Raptors, he'll be a fan favorite in Toronto. Dwayne Wade of the Miami Heat, Paul George of the Indiana Pacers, and Carmelo Anthony of the New York Knicks. NBA All-Star Game, February 14th in Toronto, Canada. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, Zimbabwe is set to resume open heart surgeries following the acquisition of new medical equipment, and a Nigerian online comic book that features black and female superheroes, well, it's gaining international attention. First, here's Mingi Mingi by the late Brenda Fassi.
You know what?
Brenda Fassie, Mingi Mingi. Well, Zimbabwe will next month resume open-heart surgeries following the acquisition of new medical equipment from the Medtronic Conduct Operations, a company based in Dublin. VOA's Erin Chikvara reports.
Open-heart surgeries, which commenced locally in 1995, were stopped in 2003 due to the country's economic meltdown and are set to resume next month amid reports that there are more than 400 patients awaiting heart operations. Since 2003, some patients have been going to countries like South Africa and India for heart surgery, while poor people in need of such medical help have died while waiting for operations. Commissioning the equipment, which consists of a heart-lung machine, a heat cooler machine, a CT machine, and an autolog cell saver, Health Deputy Minister Adrian Musiwa said performing surgeries in Zimbabwe would ensure accessibility by those who can't afford to go to other nations to seek medical attention.
Performing the surgery in Zimbabwe has its advantages, among them accessibility by the ordinary person in the streets who initially were unable to afford to go to India or South Africa. The much needed foreign currency will also be spared in the process.
Cardiothoracic surgeon Dr. David Chimuka, who will be in charge of the heart surgeries, commended Medtronic for giving Zimbabwe the equipment, adding that government must ensure that accessories would be availed timeously so that people can get the necessary medical attention.
This heart team must be given the privilege of saying what we want, we must be provided. There is no way you can wait for a heart when you get a disease or something to sort out and say, I'm going to wait for 10 or for 6 weeks. The heart will be gone. It will be dead and the person will be dead.
Dr. Chimuka said surgeries that would be conducted in conjunction with experts from South Korea will commence soon with a batch of 10 children followed by a group of 30 adults. He said a lot of patients with heart valve problems need urgent help to save their lives.
At the present moment, we know that well that a lot of our patients have got problems with heart valves, and so they need new valves in their hearts or the valves being repaired. We know there's an average of about 200 to 300 adult patients who need heart surgery. And in terms of children, a lot of children, like in any other part of the world, 10% of the children who are born have got a heart, congenital heart disease. The same thing here in Zimbabwe, we have about 100 to 150 children who need heart surgery.
It costs on average $4,000 and $6,000 for an operation for a child and adult, respectively. Dr. Chimuka said this was far much less compared to India and South Africa, where patients also incurred traveling costs. He said the problem of heart disease was serious in Zimbabwe, and they intend to conduct operations during weekends in order to clear patients on the waiting list. From Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Growing up in Nigeria, Jide Martin would often ask himself, what would Superman do? Well, today he wants young people in Africa to be able to ask themselves, what would Guardian Prime do? Guardian Prime is one of nine African superheroes who are part of the Comic Republic's lineup of characters. Martin launched Comic Republic in 2013 because he thought there should be more comics that showcased Black and African characters. Of the nine featured heroes dubbed Africa's Avengers by some fans, four of them are female. Martin tells Ricky Shryock that since the launch of the comic, they have seen their monthly online issue grow from hundreds of downloads each month to 25,000 at the end of 2015.
I think the demand for African comics is new. People really like stuff that is new. It almost feels like a fresh start. Also, you're not used to seeing a comic book that's just basically African. When I mean African, I mean, you know, Black folk. Most of our comics are dominated by white people, which is not a bad thing, in my opinion, but let's take it differently. I mean, being a hero doesn't have to mean they're mostly white. They could come from anywhere in the world, and that's why we're like, okay, you know what? Imagine we had our own superheroes in Africa.
Could you tell me a little bit about your inspiration for making these African-inspired characters?
Basically, for me, it's more like, you know, we're in the generation where morals are really low. People don't really believe in the icons of old, you know, things like religion, traditions don't really mean anything anymore. It was a point where I thought, okay, you know what, when I was growing up, things were a lot better. And I was thinking, what did I used to use to make my own decisions? And I remember clearly that whenever I wanted to do something, I was like, what would Superman do? Or what would Batman do? And, you know, I was like, okay, that's because I read comics. I thought, why don't I use that same medium to, you know, like, create like some kind of moral code. Heroes are supposed to be iconic and basically they inspire young people. And nowadays, even old people too.
I think one of the most interesting things about these African Avengers, the feature in your comics, is that I believe you have gender equality in the comics, and you said that that kind of just happened because naturally you didn't do it on purpose. But could you talk about that a little bit more? Because in comparison to more Western-based comics, that's actually quite rare.
Funny enough, where I'm from, Western Nigeria, we don't have the problem with, you know, women inequality, at least where I'm from. It's not something we think about. We love our women. We consider them equal. We thought, why not? Why not female superheroes? I mean, they're better looking.
Do you have any female artists who work for the comic book? I believe you're a 9-person team.
No, we don't have any female person that draws, that does illustrations, but our head of marketing and corporate communication, yes, she's female.
You said that some of what the characters do in the comic is work for a better, safer Africa, to improve Nigeria. Do you touch on any current events in your comics?
Because we're a startup, we're trying to play safe. That's the honest truth. It's not like we don't want to touch on major issues. So we're sticking to science fiction for now. And the reason why we're doing that is because we still want to become a household name. It'll come to a time when, you know, we've gotten enough clout and we're stable, or we've gotten to the point where it will be our social responsibility to take on issues that, you know, affect the general public. But basically right now we're sticking to using fictional stories to teach people how to make the right decision, how to be morally ethical.
That was Jide Martin, founder of Comic Republic, speaking to Ricky Shryock from Lagos, Nigeria. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society. obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aine, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.